It's often said that the best way to get to the CTO title at a company is, of course, to found that company. In fact, that's exactly how I did it in my career. But it's not the path Camille Cindy, our guest on today's show, took to get into that role. In fact, Camille worked his way up at his current employer, JW Player, from data science manager to director of engineering to VP of engineering before finally taking the helm as CTO last year. His journey, of course, did not start at JW Player. Prior to there, Camille did a degree in math and computer science at MIT before launching his career as an analyst at Goldman Sachs. Along his path, he's also spent time at Nebula Capital Management as an analyst and at Better Mortgage as lead data engineer. Be sure to stick around as we catch up with Camille Cindy and hear his path to the C-suite.
You're listening to the Developmentor podcast, hosted by Grant Ingersoll. We have one goal on the show, to help you build a successful career in tech, no matter where you're from or where you're going. We do this by showcasing interesting people working across a variety of roles in tech and deep dive into their why. If you want to learn more, please visit our website at developmentor.com or follow us on Twitter at @developmentor.
Cloud computing has changed the way we live, do business, and stay connected. With everyone using the same cloud platforms, winning and losing comes down to having the best talent to build products better and faster. So whether you're an aspiring developer looking to level up, a product manager looking to capitalize on machine learning, or a CTO like me wondering what all the buzz is about for Kubernetes, tech and cloud skills have never been more important. This is why we have teamed up with Cloud Academy here at Developmentor. Cloud Academy brings you thousands of video courses, learning paths, practical hands-on labs in real-world cloud environments, and tools designed to help teams assess, build, and validate critical cloud skills. Most importantly, Cloud Academy stays agile, challenging you with new content, labs, and tons of features that ensure your skills stay relevant and everyone can level up. They cover everything from major certifications to DevOps, security to programming languages. I'm using my free trial time to brush up on my understanding of Kubernetes essentials and serverless principles. Cloud Academy is the cloud training platform of choice for Fortune 500 companies and thousands of tech professionals around the world. Don't just take their word for it, though. Check out their reviews on G2 and get started now at cloudacademy.com. For a limited time, our listeners can lock in 50% off the monthly price for life. Just put in the coupon code MENTOR when checking out. It's a great way to pursue certifications or just build expertise during these uncertain times. Again, go to cloudacademy.com and use the coupon code MENTOR, M-E-N-T-O-R, to lock in 50% off the monthly price. Camille, great to have you on the show. Welcome aboard to the Developmentor podcast.
Hey, Grant. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I trust you are doing well. I know you are up in New York City. I know I'm sure that's been quite stressful, but by the fact that you're here, I'm at least assuming that you're doing okay, despite all of what's going on in the world.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure to be here, and things are going well.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And, you know, it's interesting. I think we were comparing notes before the show. We know some of the same people, you know, especially in the New York tech scene, but we haven't actually met. So very much appreciate you taking the time to join me from what I'm sure is a busy schedule.
Pleasure.
Well, and so I would love to kick things off here, Camille, and really dig in on what inspired you to get into tech. I know you went to MIT. Like, what actually inspired you to even go that route, like go to MIT and get a comp sci degree?
Yeah, you know, so at that time when I was graduating from MIT, I think I was 19 years old, and a lot of my focus was in math, but again, I was really interested in theoretical math, but I also wanted to make sure that I was employable long-term, and so I also did a focus in computer science. I would say my background's a bit semi-traditional, where I started out in finance because that was the thing to do at that time. It was 2007. Everybody was doing a hedge fund or investment banking, and tech wasn't so big as it is today. And so I started out as an analyst role at Goldman Sachs in London. And then I joined a hedge fund, figuring out trading signals, ingesting market data. And during my time at Nebula Capital, I was finding the job to be a bit Markovian, where you figure out a trading signal, you trade it, you make money, and then onto the next signal. So it was really much like a sort of a rinse and repeat. But you weren't like building on top of something foundational or like you do with a product development. And one of my aha moments was I remember building this CMS at the fund as a side project for analysts, where we can have a quick overview of companies, like the important like quantum mental signals that we should be trading on. And I found it really satisfying building this project, getting feedback and improving upon it. That's really when I fell in love with like technology and how impactful it can be.
I want to make sure I heard something right up front. Did you say you graduated MIT at 19?
I like to get a head start and graduate from MIT.
I love it. So, you're saying you had this traditional path, but like graduating MIT at 19, tell me a little bit more about that, because that must have meant like you got a pretty early start in math and comp sci, right? I mean, like, was this a love as a child that was just like, at 15, you're saying, I got to go off to MIT?
It was almost like a huge, deep love for math and just like teaching myself. And actually, I grew up in Switzerland, where there wasn't even like access to like doing things like AP exams. It was like a British system. And yeah, I just like self-taught on a lot of things in the beginning, and like whether it was a calculus, etc. And I enjoyed it, like taking tests and doing like the AP exams. And so I kind of just found myself learning so much, and I decided like maybe I can apply early to MIT and see if they accept me. And I got lucky and got accepted there.
Yeah, that's fantastic. But so then that must have been a little bit surreal of like, okay, you're 19 and here you are going out into the working world. I mean, you know, I don't know, at 19, I wasn't, you know, I knew I was going to be there, but I wasn't ready to be there. I'm curious as to what that was like for you in terms of, I'm assuming then you're also living on your own. You said, I think you were in London. Is that right?
Yeah, I was in London. My parents live there. And so I was staying with them. It was definitely surreal, and I was like, you know, a bit naive. And like one of the problems of graduating a bit early sometimes is you think you figure everything out, but then going and starting a job and getting that experience and just seeing how different it is from sort of like academics was very eye-opening for me.
Yeah, for sure. I bet that was a bit surreal. That very first job at Goldman Sachs, I mean, it has a title analyst, which when I think of analyst at Goldman Sachs, I'm thinking somebody who's, you know, researching stock picks, they're writing up reports, they're doing quantitative or qualitative analysis on equities or bonds or whatever. And yet you had also this comp sci degree. So I imagine obviously the math fits into the quantitative side. Were you doing programming as well at that time? Or, you know, like tell me about that early role a bit more.
At Goldman, it was really like a traditional like analyst role where it was mostly like Excel, and only programming was maybe like, I think it's called like VBA, right? And it was a lot of PowerPoint. But at the hedge fund at Nebula Capital, that's where really I got to use my programming skills, where it was more like a quant shop. And I was able to like ingest data, learn like best practices. And there was a lot of good software developers there as well. At Goldman, it was more, I would say, the traditional like analyst role.
And so then Nebula is where you kind of, I think you mentioned you started to find that love for programming, because presumably you had done some programming as part of the comp sci degree or with alongside the math work that you were doing, right?
Right. I did it more on the side when I was in London, but then as a career and as a job, it really started out at Nebula.
Ah, interesting. That makes sense then. All right. Because actually, as I was looking at your profile, I'm like, okay, when did this leap happen? You had computer science, but then you went into analyst, and then you went into data engineering. So thanks for clarifying that. That makes a lot more sense. Well, so I'm kind of curious then, you know, from those early career opportunities into then going into more formal programming and data science. I'm kind of curious, like, how were you thinking about your career at, you know, 19, 20? Like, what was your mindset and how has it evolved over the years?
When I started out, I was so like set on being in finance and then eventually like joining like a big hedge fund, like a, you know, a Rentech or a DeIsha. And I was thinking of myself as wanting to really, really like specialize in quantitative finance. And sort of over time, I actually started realizing I really love being more, instead of a specialist, a generalist, because you get to like wear many hats, you get to be good at a lot of different things, maybe not necessarily an expert. I had a big decision point when I was 8 years into finance was like, do I stay in finance and really like specialize and become like this expert? Or do I take this entirely different career path and become more of a generalist? And at that time, like data science was becoming a thing. And it really like fit this like my polymath tendencies of I love programming, I love doing analysis, I love doing data science, I love thinking about business problems. It was like a role I'd love.
And so that's when you made that jump over to, I'm assuming, Better Mortgage, or was that within Nebula as well, where you kind of raised your hand and said, hey, I'd like to do this other thing?
It was really like during the 7 years at Nebula.
Oh, nice. So you found a manager, or you had a manager that was generally supportive of you making a career shift.
Yeah, exactly. And then this manager was like a super interesting person, like a Java whiz, and somebody who taught me a lot and gave me a lot of exposure to being a really good software developer and just thinking about like data engineering in general as well.
You know, it's interesting, and I would love to dive into that a little bit because, like, you know, I think for a lot of our listeners, probably me as well, like, it's often the case that we think, well, if I'm going to make a shift like this, I probably have to leave my company. I'm curious from your perspective, any, like, tips or insights as to how best to approach that type of conversation with your manager? Because, you know, I mean, you're a manager now, like, you have this role and, you know, sure, yes, I want you to grow and I want to help you in your career, but I also need you to do your job in the moment, right? And so how did you approach that with your manager and with your company?
First, I think it's really important just to speak with peers and different people of the company and just understand what they're doing and if it's really like interesting to you. And then another one is just either doing side projects or initiatives to explore and learn yourself. So like what I do, for example, is I encourage people to work on as many different projects as possible and really like just get exposure to different problem sets. I think that's the way to start to explore something is just trying it out, even if it's on the side.
Yeah, that's such great advice. I mean, we all are, of course, busy, but you often, you know, if it's important, you can find time. So I love that. What's interesting next is then you did leap into, you know, this officially as a role, a lead data engineer role. I mean, did you find it challenging at making that leap from the way your resume looked? Like you've had this analyst title, you were at a fintech company. Did you have to do anything to kind of quote unquote convince people that, hey, no, really, I'm a data engineer. I'm ready for this piece? Or was it just anybody who talked to you, it was obvious?
I think the good thing is I had like the tech background and, you know, a lot of the interviews focus on sort of like answering questions and doing algorithms. So that's where like people were comfortable. But it was still hard because I think coming from finance over to tech, there's just so many differences and sometimes even in culture. And I remember like somebody commenting because I remember interviewing with like a blazer. And they thought it was like super weird that I interviewed and was dressed formally for a tech job. And they asked me, like, are you going to wear like a suit every time you come to the office? I remember this person asking me. I think it was just a different like mindset. And sometimes just the processes around things like agile are different. Like it took me some time to like just understand the exact like lingo.
I hope you said yes to that question. Are you going to dress that way? And it reminds me of a friend of mine who worked in San Francisco. And I think like every day he would dress up for work in downtown San Francisco as an engineer. And his explanation was, hey, I'm counterculture. You know, you're all dressed in t-shirts and jeans. I'm going to dress up just to be counterculture. I'm the edgy one, not you. You look like everybody else.
I wouldn't have been as successful in maybe San Francisco, but at least in New York, like I think people dress up a bit more.
It was funny being a bi-coastal CTO in my role, previous role, like go to San Francisco, all right, jeans and t-shirt, go to Wall Street or New York and it's button down and dress pants, or maybe you could get away with button down and jeans. I mentioned in the lead-in, you know, that the easiest way to get the CTO title, in fact, I think Camille Fournier, who I think we may both know, at least in passing, one of the things she talks about in her book, The Manager's Path, is the easiest way to get the CTO title is to start your own company. And she repeated that in episode 4 of the show. And yet, you know, you did it the hard way. Not that starting your own company is the easy either, but you worked your way up the ranks. You know, so tell us about that journey of, you know, first off, what inspired you to go into management where you said, okay, I now want a management job as opposed to an individual contributor. And then that path of working your way up through, you know, manager to director to VP to CTO.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the sort of the theme for my career is really wanting and enjoying this like generalist role versus becoming like a pure specialist. And what I really like about that sort of the manager role is one, of course, and especially the higher you get is having the impact. But I think also what's fun is that you have to become like a jack of all trades. You have to have a really strong sense of technology, but then also you have to develop this completely different skill set of managing people or like interfacing with maybe non-tech folks, whether it's sales, marketing, or even product. And so for me, what was great was I could like develop all these different skill sets that I really enjoy.
That's so true. I'm smiling here because, you know, like that for me, like that realization that you can, it's like this whole new worlds are opening up of sales and marketing and all these other aspects. And all of a sudden the problem space is even greater than it ever was as an engineer. And not that it's not fun as an engineer, but I'm curious then, you know, like what are some of the key lessons you've learned along the way? Like perhaps at each of those stops, like what are one or two things that you learned and built on to get to that next level?
Yeah, you know, for me, I think that the first and foremost is recognizing that engineering management, especially like being an engineering manager, is an entirely different skill set. And actually like have a GitHub repo where I just record my thoughts. I call like the manager's playbook. And for me, I think it's really important to like take a step back and think about what skills are required and whether it's like conducting good one-on-ones, giving feedback. For me, I think step one for being any manager is to really hone those skills and appreciate how different of a role it is. And then as you sort of, I found like going higher up in terms of my role, it really is around communication and execution. And you know, not only is it communicating down, but it's also communicating up and figuring out like how to translate like technology problems and business requirements. And communication can't be stressed enough. I can't stress it enough in terms of how important it is in that role because it's a force multiplier. One thing I've learned, especially as CTO, is, you know, the higher up you go, like the more opportunities there are in terms of like improving things. And really it's around like focusing and knowing that oftentimes it's like you have to focus on maybe 5 things, even if you have like maybe 100 different opportunities, like the top 5 things will drive the needle. And it's really like being laser focused on that. And that will like define success.
Picking the 5 out of the 100, that can be so difficult at times, especially in a large complex system. So
if you are missing live conferences like I am, be sure to check out the new online series of conferences from Manning Publications called Live at Manning. As many of you know, Manning has been a great supporter of the show, offering free books and discounts for our listeners. We've teamed up with them as a media sponsor to spread the word on this new series. These conferences are free to attend, filled with talks from some really great tech experts, and streamed globally via Twitch. No travel needed. Next up in the Live at Manning series is a one-day event focused on women in tech. It is on October 13th, starting at 12 p.m. Eastern. This is your chance to hear from speakers like Cornelia Davis, who you heard here in episode 88, and Emily Robinson, who you heard here in episode 76. Plus, you can learn about topics like algorithmic engineering on large data sets and get the latest on virtual reality. head over to developmentor.com/womenintech, all one word, all lowercase, to find out more. In case you didn't catch that, there's going to be a link in your show notes. We'll see you there.
I'm curious, you know, so you mentioned a couple of really great things in there, ranging from the good one-on-ones and feedback through to communication. For our listeners who perhaps haven't been in management role or are trying to get better in a management role, like, what's a tip on, say, having a good one-on-one, right? Like, what do you see as the keys to having a good one-on-one?
For me, what's like key to one-on-ones is, and this might sound obvious, is to like never skip them. It's like the best platform for receiving and giving feedback. And what I like to do is like focus on five topics. One is around predictability. So setting expectations, like feeling like there's this routine that you're checking in and you're like giving and receiving feedback. I think another one is figuring out how to offer more ownership to the direct report, whether it's clarifying it or saying like offering more responsibilities, because oftentimes like people don't know that they can ask for more responsibility or they want to grow in a different way. And so that's important. Another one is just clarifying things like what the big picture or purpose is, talking about the the tasks at hand, seeing if you can help unblock things. And then the last two I see are, one is just creating this sense of progress with the person in terms of like talking about milestones, celebrating wins, and then just checking in with this person in terms of how they're doing like culturally and with the team. So I think like those are really like the five topics that I like to focus on. And I like to start it out with each of these, with a question on each of these topics, and ask the person like on a scale of 1 to 10, how clear they feel like what's expected of them. And by them giving me a number, I can start saying, well, why is this only a 7 or and how can we improve it?
I love that. I'm gonna steal that. That's fantastic. Well, and then also, you know, I mean, us engineers aren't always, let's say, gifted with communication, verbal human to human communication skills. We're very good at communicating via code and via other forms. But what helped you in that realm? Like, maybe what are some things that helped you become a better communicator over the years?
You know, it's like, I think what helped me a lot was reading a lot of things from Amazon, which is, you know, interesting, is that like, I think it's a really great culture when it comes to communicating and being like outcome driven. And so for me, what was really helpful was seeing some ex-Amazonians, how they work and how they communicate things, whether it's like favoring like a long form writing over writing presentations, or even just how they like write emails, for example. And so what I find helpful, because I don't consider myself a great writer, is thinking about things in bullet points and how it will come across to the person reading it.
If you have some links, maybe we can link those up in the show notes afterwards. So I'd love to be able to share some of that. Or I'm sure our listeners probably could Google Amazon, you know, culture, Amazon leadership principles. Is that right?
Yeah, and I'm happy to share with you. Actually, like, so what I've done for myself, and this is what I share with my managers, is I have a public repo I call a manager's playbook, and it kind of goes through a lot of these different things that I've learned and just notes that I found interesting, whether it's on feedback, coaching, or one-on-ones, or just even writing. So happy to share that afterwards.
Oh, that's fantastic. It reminds me of an earlier guest, Lori Apple. She also had a leadership and management GitHub repo for these kinds of things. So maybe we should do a pull request between both of them. So we'll be sure to link that up in the show notes. I'm curious then for you, Camille, is like, what changed about being in the C-suite, or what did you find most surprising about being at that level?
In terms of like the most surprising thing at that level is, and sometimes I don't realize it, is I'm the most technical person there. And you have to sometimes maybe translate things or manage expectations in a different way or communicate it in a way where non-engineers maybe would see it in a different way. And so I think for me, that was maybe the biggest surprise, is speaking with non-engineers who want to understand things or who have a different lens, just making sure that I'm resonating with them in a different way.
Yeah. And then likewise, understanding them as well, right? Because they, you know, legal speaks very different from finance, from operations, from marketing, from sales, through product usually you tend to speak at least a shared language for the most part. But and then depending on your CEO's background as well, are they more coming from a product and engineering background, or are they coming from a sales and marketing background? That tends to be where most CEOs come from, but not always.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I mean, like with the CFO, I might be focused on helping figure out unit economics, but for somebody like the head of sales, maybe it's figuring out like what features we should say yes or no to win that next big enterprise contract.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, it's so true, like just all the different dynamics. But I guess, you know, that goes in many ways to that being a generalist. Joining the C-suite is to be that ultimate generalist, but you give up a whole lot of detail in the process for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, over time, and that's something that, you know, I haven't experienced yet, but you start not being like super well versed in like the latest technologies. And then sort of it's navigating that, which is interesting, where you kind of want to keep that generalist, but maybe you won't know like how to scale Kafka as well anymore.
I could still do that if I really wanted. Well, I'm curious too, like the inflection point of going to be a manager, like did you struggle with that kind of back and forth? I know, like, for instance, Charity Majors has this great post, and she was an earlier guest on kind of the pendulum of back and forth between IC and manager. Did you struggle with that yourself?
Yeah, no, huge fan of Charity Majors and that article. I still sometimes code of my free time, and if it's like side projects. But for me, like I'm just so interested in like the business aspects of things and the product. And so I didn't feel like I was giving up coding too much, because I always felt like I couldn't do some things on the side, whether it's like maybe like at the moment, like my small side projects, like writing a Go client for this new baby monitor. But I also don't miss like writing production code and having to worry about like bringing the system down, or, you know, making sure I didn't like miss an edge case.
I know I'll go back to writing code more frequently at some point in my life, but like you said, I don't miss that day to day as much either. And I do exactly the same approach, which is side projects and things like that. So I'm curious, you know, so I have a coach, and my coach asked me this the other day, and it was such a thought provoking question that I thought, well, I need to use that in my podcast. And I often in the past have asked about, you know, challenges in a role and things like that. But I'm curious, like when you think about your career or being in your role, like when are you at your best? Like what gets you going? What wakes, you know, like you wake up and you're like, I can't wait to tackle this kind of problem.
You know, for me, I think what really gets me excited is when I have like an impact on the business and we're solving like an interesting challenge there. You know, I really enjoy like joining sales calls and figuring out, okay, this feature needs to get done. Like, how do we prioritize that? But at the same time, like not like sort of ruin the roadmap. And so I think what I really enjoy is like, how can I have like that direct impact on the business? Cause that's the feedback loop where I feel like, okay, I'm doing a good job. And I think why everybody loves software development and they miss it is you get that immediate feedback loop when things go well.
Well, and then, you know, kind of the flip side, because I think we often portray, you know, especially in this social media rich environment where everybody's always having fun on vacation and in a great place. I mean, what's been the toughest part of maybe the role or the career? Like, what's something that, you know, like you had to really work your way through and figure out that perhaps didn't come as natural?
I think the most part that did not come as natural, it was really on the managing people side, where I felt like, okay, this is a real skill that needs to get developed. And, you know, I was fortunate to take some management courses by Life Labs. That's when I really started enjoying it and understanding like how important and different it is, whether it's like providing feedback or conducting one-on-ones. Those are the kinds of things that where it doesn't feel as natural when you're just coming from like software development.
Do you recall, like, I'm always curious with leaders, do you recall like when the switch flipped for you?
You know, I think the aha moment for me where I was like, well, okay, this is actually like a very important skill. It was around coaching. So like, I think that the biggest one where I thought was really powerful was it's a best practice, like especially when you're coaching somebody, is to ask like what some people call like open questions. So like what, how, who, as opposed to like asking closed questions or binary questions where that start with like do, is, have. And for me, that was like a aha moment. It's like, oh yeah, it's so different to ask somebody what questions do you have versus do you have any questions, right? Because like the latter is more of like a decision one. It's almost like asymmetric in terms of like the power. And when you're asking open questions, like you're really giving this person ownership. You're letting them like have that responsibility. And so for me, that first time I heard it, I was like, wow, this is important and impactful for how I have relationships with people.
I can recall a similar moment of like, and I still struggle with asking questions at times, but my personal mantra is like, ask better questions. Like that's one of the little things I tell myself is I try to get better at asking questions. And so I love this because that is such a good segue to my next one, which is I'm going to ask you the question, which is, what's a question I should have asked you about your career, but didn't? What's something perhaps that doesn't show up that is illustrative of your career and kind of the choices you've made and the inflection points that you've had to work through?
Yeah, I feel like we covered a lot of the big ones. I think it was more maybe the decision to go from finance to tech, which we talked a bit about. That to me was such a like big moment.
You know, Camille, the show is Developmentor. You know, I think mentors can be such important aspects of our life. You know, especially I think for somebody who's going into the workforce at a younger age than many, I'm curious for you to reflect on relationships or friends or mentors that have had an impact on you and what you've learned from them.
And actually, that's a really good point where as you go more and more into like the management or executive role, I think what can never be discounted is relationships. I find almost my job is a lot about having relationships within the org and like building trust and communicating. And so for me, I think the way I think about it is, and what I encourage people to do is always build relationships with as many people as possible, whether you move on from a company or not, is really to keep them. And one career advice I always give is like optimize for optionality and anti-fragility. So on the optionality side is by having like a big network of people and friends that you care about and where you help each other, it just opens so many doors. And that's how I found it for myself. Like joining Nebula, for example, it was really through like friends of friends, or even like Better Mortgage, what was knowing of Eric Bernardson and speaking with him. And I know he was a guest on your show. So I just think like relationships are just such an important part of, especially the executive.
Yeah. And Eric was in fact just a recent guest. So yeah, thanks for referring there. I mean, I think that networking aspect is so true. Maybe one or two tips there, because, you know, I think a lot of times, especially I've seen in engineering cultures, oh, you know, that's fake stuff. You know, that's, you know, something salespeople do or something like that, like in a derogatory way, but clearly it's so important. I mean, I've seen this in my own career. I'm kind of curious as to how you approached networking. Maybe what are some tips that have been helpful for you there?
Yeah, so for me, I think the most important thing is that it's always about quality and not quantity. You can have like a really vast network, but in the end, it doesn't do much for you. And really, it's about quality of like building people that where you trust each other, you help each other out, you lean on each other for advice, especially like for me, what I like to do is I like to speak with CTOs like yourself and others and really get feedback in terms of how they think about approaching problems. To me, it's really about like teaching and learning from each other and finding people who might be better than you in some aspects that you can just grow and learn from. So it's really important with the relationships and this happens naturally, is finding people who you aspire to be and or learn from.
Fantastic. I'm also curious in your advice there, you mentioned, you know, I love the optionality. Explain a little bit more for our listeners this anti-fragility side of it, because I think that's something that's often overlooked in a career path. And so tell me a little bit more about how you approach that.
Yeah, the way I think about anti-fragility, and I think it's a concept from Nassim Taleb's book, Anti-Fragile, is, and it goes back to how I think about like specialist versus generalist. When you think about your career path is like, 5 or 10 years from now, what does that look like? And how sort of immune it is to like just the changing technology landscape. Like things change really quickly. And even like just specializing in certain jobs where there's like even data engineering or oil trading, there are limits to it. So I think it's really important to think about sort of at a higher level in terms of what you want to be good at and develop those skills, because market shifts fast and you want to make sure that like you're building careers that's for the long term that you really enjoy.
Yeah, I love that. It reminds me of James Clear, his Atomic Habits, and his book. He talks about identity. And so often we get attached to the identity of we are a specific thing. And I think what I'm hearing from you is it fits along those lines, which is more think about it at a higher order plane. You don't have to specifically be an oil trading data engineer. You are a software engineer that happens to know how to do oil trading or something along those lines, right? I love that, Camille. And so many great pieces of advice in there. I'm kind of curious to have you then wrap it all up. You know, if you took all of the advice you have and put a bow on it, what's your best career advice for people?
I think it would have to go back to, I kind of would think about it for, maybe I can I break it down into maybe four or so bullet points that come to my mind? So, and kind of just to summarize it. So I think one is just optimize for that optionality. And so whether that's having a good network or exposing yourself to different industries, I think like companies get created because people have exposures to different industries and see the problems there. If you just find yourself like much focused on like fintech or finance, you're just going to think of problems for that industry. And if you expose yourself to different things, you kind of stumble on maybe really interesting ideas. I think another one is just surrounding yourself with people you look up to and whose like skill sets that you want to emulate. Third, and we kind of touched on this a bit, is just like don't get into management for the wrong reasons. Like one thing I like to do is ask people who want to get into management like how they feel about deadlines. Nick Caldwell, who also I think was a guest of yours, I think he like tweeted or something about like avoid Kampfdesk, and I think that comes from like Blade Runner, where like you can ask people certain questions about how they feel about something if they're ready to be a manager, especially like from an interview if you're interviewing somebody for a manager position. And I think one was interesting was like, well, how do you feel about deadlines? And like the way a manager thinks about it is so different. And especially how I think about it is very different from like an engineer. Like I need to build this like predictable process. An engineer is like, it's typically is like, it's done when it's done. Like this is like an art for me. And it's not about, you know, churning widgets. And I think the last one is just not to specialize too early unless you're extremely passionate about the problem, about something. Like it's okay to be a generalist and grow from there.
Yeah, such good advice in there. I love, especially the last one rings so true for me on as a liberal arts major, went to a liberal arts college. It reminds me of, I think it's David Epstein's book called Range, where he talks a lot about specialists versus generalists. And I know for me, one of the best things in my career is I actually worked at a really small company, but we did a lot of different things. And so I got to wear a lot of different hats in my very first role. I got to be sysadmin, I got to be junior programmer, I got to do some sales presentations and things like that. And it paid off later. I didn't know it in the moment, but it really did pay off later through that exposure to a lot of different ideas, especially when you're in 20s. Like that can be really powerful because, frankly, most people don't know.
And it's funny, that's exactly how I felt about Nebula Capital was, by exposing yourself to these different things, it pays off later where I feel so comfortable like doing spreadsheets and unit economics with our CFO because of spending that time and getting that exposure.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and I know like for me, like same kind of thing with my CFO is, you know, having spent time in sales and knowing what it means to carry a number and carry a bag, as the salespeople call it, you know, the real briefcase, if you will, and go out and try to bring in revenue. Like you think about how you build software differently, and it makes you a better engineer, even if you never want to be in a C-suite or never be a manager. Camille, it's so great to have you on the show. One final question, which is, you know, so I think you shared this GitHub playbook, but where can our listeners best follow you, learn from you, connect with you, and dig in with you on how to be a better manager or be a better engineer?
You know, I think probably the best is Twitter, if people kind of like dad jokes and about tech and just sharing a bunch of articles. But generally, I'm active on Twitter.
All right. Well, we definitely love dad jokes on this show. I know I get accused of dad jokes in my home life, so I am not going to go there right now with you. But we will be sure to link up your Twitter profile in the show notes, as well as your LinkedIn profile. Camille, it's so great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure, Grant. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Developmentor podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Even better, please leave us a review. If you want to hear older episodes, leave feedback, or sign up to be a guest, please visit us at developmentor.com. If you'd like to support the show, there are three ways you can help out. 1. Make a donation via Patreon. 2. If you're a software engineer looking for your next gig and wanting to practice interviewing, use our referral link to the interviewing.io platform. And 3. Buy your next tech book from Manning Publications using our affiliate link. All of those links can be found at developmentor.com/support-us. That's SUPPORT-US, all one word. Most importantly, if you like this show, please tell your friends. Referrals are the lifeblood of any podcast. Finally, we here at Developmentor hope that each and every episode helps you move one step closer to finding your path.